Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. Discover how you can take charge of the all-new Corsa E on opel.ie.
Last night we heard that another 3,569 people have been infected with COVID-19 and 63 deaths were confirmed by the Department of Health. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Colman O'Loughlin, President of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland and Consultant at Intensive Care in the Mater Hospital. And in a moment we'll speak to Professor Ross Morgan, who's a respiratory consultant at Beaumont Hospital. Colman, good morning to you first.
Good morning, Claire.
We last spoke late on Monday night when we were outside the Mater Hospital and you were telling us about the challenges that you're facing. They're only increasing.
Yeah, you know, the numbers are going up. That's reported every day. I'm lucky enough here in the hospital to have access to a live dashboard of intensive care capacity across the country. And as updated by just a few minutes past 10 o'clock this morning, it looks like 172 patients in ICU, 101 of whom are on ventilators. I suppose it's kind of interesting as well at this point, because we're 2 weeks into this kind of new surge, if you like, that we're seeing a phenomenon that we saw last time as well, is that obviously patients who come into ICU, a lot of them are discharged and start their journey to recovery. So we've had 14 admissions overnight to ICUs across the country. We've also had 11 discharges. I think that's very encouraging. I think that's an important message to get out. Mm-hmm. In terms of intensive care, it sometimes is portrayed as all doom and gloom, and ventilators are very advanced forms of therapy to need to be put on. But it's important to say about 70-80% of intensive care patients so far in this pandemic have survived ICU and started their journey to recovery at that point.
So when you tell us that there are 172 patients in ICU across the country, can you put that into context for us and what that means for the system?
Well, I mean, it means there are 172 patients with a disease we didn't have a year ago. Our bed capacity at the moment, the number of patients in intensive care all told, is 286, adding in the non-COVID patients, which continue to come through the door on a daily basis as well. And we started this journey in January, say, of 2020, with about 270 beds approximately available to the system. So we've gone beyond what our baseline stock is. So that means hospitals are surging into areas that they haven't had to work in before. And that varies across the country because not every ICU is built the same way. They're built to meet the needs of the local hospital and local specialties in those hospitals. So some hospitals don't have a huge amount of flexibility in their system and others do. So for example, we would have a lot of ICU beds dedicated to cardiac surgery. We've put that cardiac surgery program on pause at our hospital, and those patients have been catered for in other institutions across the city. So we have access to those beds. So we have more flexibility, for example, than a hospital that doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. So each hospital will surge differently at different times depending on that. But it has happened. I'm aware of Dr. Enda O'Connor and James reporting last night on the news that they're into certainly level 2 or 3 of their surge plan. And they are under a lot of pressure. They have a lot of patients with COVID in their ICU and non-COVID patients, obviously. And we're not under that pressure right at the moment.
We look at this from the outside and we think, oh, you have surge capacity, so we take some comfort from that. But there must be a huge challenge there in using that surge capacity.
Yeah, I mean, surge, it's probably an unfortunate word that doesn't deliver the kind of negative connotations to, I suppose, your listeners as it does to us. It really is not a word we use lightly, and it's something we don't want to get to. What it really means is putting patients in areas that never intended to look after critical care patients, and it means staff are flexed across that, and they're stretched. And what it does mean ultimately is that the quality of care that we're able to give those patients, not those patients, but all patients if we hit surge, is going to be diluted. And the greater the surge, the more dilution of that care. And we just have no way of telling people what that means in real terms, in terms of outcomes, because it's never happened to us before. We have, I suppose, some indication from other countries, and certainly UK and London, when they surged last year, they would seem to have had a different mortality rate than we had. They had an increased mortality in their ICU than we had. And it is being put down to the fact that their critical care staff were too stretched to deliver that quality of care that they've never had to do before. So
Their mortality rate was around 40% as opposed to 20% here. Is that right?
That's approximately right, yeah. Across their all intensive care units. And it seemed to be higher in the areas in the UK that had more admissions to intensive care and more surge areas around London, etc., seem to have higher mortality than areas that didn't. It's not as simple as that, but certainly there's a view that if we have to go there, which it looks increasingly likely, that we possibly will see a change in our mortality. But we can't predict that. We don't know until it's all over. But that's a huge worry for us, that we will dilute care.
And what about the profile of the patients that are coming to you in ICU? Is there any change there, or is it very similar to what we saw in the first wave?
I would have to say mostly similar. We would be looking at, in our ICU at the moment, and I don't want to pick out defined populations, but most of our patients are between 60 and 70. A lot of them have background illnesses of diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and are overweight, not all. But we have seen younger patients coming through. Certainly, because this virus is circulating far more widely than it was before, a greater percentage of young people are being infected and coming to hospital. And as I said to you before, we've had a pregnant lady come through who was required HDU level care and a lot of oxygen. She's getting better, thankfully, but that's new to us. That certainly didn't happen last year at any stage. So it is different, and I know from our ED colleagues they're seeing a lot more younger patients coming through. Thankfully, very few of them come to need ICU. But it's reported across the hospital there's definitely a lot more younger patients involved this time.
Yeah, just the specifics on that. It was reported last night that there were 3 patients in ICU aged between 19 and 34, 18 patients aged between 35 and 54.
Yeah, it is a disease that affects everybody. Obviously, the younger and the healthier you are, you're far less likely to get severely sick with it. But there are a lot of people who are younger who have other comorbidities. They're more at risk. And certainly, I am aware of patients who seem to have no risk in the younger age category who've needed support from high dependency and intensive care. It is a worry, and people need to be aware of that. I suppose I can inform people as well that the chances of them having a poor outcome is very low. They tend to do well, but they get very sick, and they do have a lot of morbidity afterwards. A lot of them have shortness of breath for a long time, a chronic cough, and all this long COVID type symptoms you've heard about as well. So you don't want to get this. You really don't want to get it at any age, because you just don't know. You can be unlucky, and we've just seen some people being very unlucky and getting very severe damage from this virus. That's unpredictable.
Clinically and professionally for you, I mean, it must be odd, I'm not sure if that's the right term, to see so many patients in ICU with the same condition.
It is unique. It's unique. We've had flu kind of epidemics before, outbreaks of flu. We've had the H1N1, the swine flu of 2009 and 10, and that certainly stressed our system quite a bit. But, to see, 170-odd patients in your ICU with the same disease is absolutely unique. And it's you have to pinch yourself from time to time to actually believe that's true. There is the odd kind of, as I say, academic side to everybody working in this industry that's kind of their interest is piqued by all of this, but it's extraordinarily challenging. It's fatiguing. It's sometimes hard to pick the emotion to attach to what we see. But the relentlessness of this virus and the relentlessness of ambulances pulling up to the hospital with people, a lot of whom are gasping for breath. To see so many people in an emergency department in the wards gasping for breath, it's very hard to comprehend, and it's very hard to put it all together. Unique, scary. As you say, it's just so difficult to pick an emotion to put to that. But there's certainly, and I think it was reported in the news, a level of stress amongst the staff. But I'd have to say also there's a huge amount of resilience in the staff, and there's a huge amount of solidarity in the staff to pull together to get through this.
Yeah, and we do, and we see that every day. We know now as well that staff who have been close contacts are being recalled back into the hospital, and there are some concerns around the safety. Are you happy that that's being managed properly?
I share the concerns, I must say. I do understand that there's public health advice given around close contacts for very good reasons. We want to limit the transmission of this virus. And, there's different types of close contacts. There's a close contact you might have had in the community, not at home. Then you have close contact of somebody who's at home with you, and that's obviously a much higher risk again. Our position, and each hospital is taking a position based on the national guidance, to absolutely do everything we can and to get the most out of the system without calling people back into work. But there is a balance here, and I think that's the crux of this argument. That's why it's such a difficult one, that we do have to provide care for our patients. We have to weigh up the balances, and there are other ways of looking at it, but certainly bringing people back in who are close contacts is on the cards, but we are trying everything we can to make sure that is the very, very last option that we take.
And just on that, remind us again, Coleman, how many staff do you need for each ICU patient?
They're staffed on a one-to-one basis, and Let's say we have an 18-bed ICU. We have an 18-bed HGU, which is slightly different staffing level. We have 18 beds in our ICU, and they have to be covered 168 hours a week, which is, you know, 24/7 every day of the year, one-to-one, because they're so sick, these patients, they have to be very intensively monitored. Mm-hmm. And to do that, and to incorporate annual leave and to incorporate maternity leave, which is obviously common in nursing staff, you're talking five to six nurses per ICU bed. And that's a standard international figure. It's an easy one to come up with, and it's practiced throughout this country and most modern countries. So that's what's needed to run an intensive care. So it's quite a challenge to get to that level, and to expand beyond that level is extraordinarily challenging. Okay. And something that works over years, months and years, rather than weeks and days.
A listener would like to know, and I know you've been asked this question before, have treatments improved or not?
Yes, we have access to treatments that have, through randomised controlled trials, have shown to be of benefit. Dexamethasone is the one that we're using on a regular basis. The steroid, it helps kind of reduce the inflammation. There's one that's just on the brink of coming on board, another form of immune modulation drug, and that helps. But unfortunately, they do help, but the impact isn't huge. You know, it's not a fantastic cure. It's not like a very good antibiotic for a bacterial infection. We're not treating the virus as such. We're treating the effects the virus has on the body, and it works on some people. But there's an awful lot of people these treatments don't work, but they do work on some people, whereas opposed to, 12 months ago, we didn't have any clue of what worked on people. So there are marginal gains in certain terms of the therapy. There's marginal gains in techniques that we use, such as proning patients in intensive care. But overall, I think for what it's really worth saying to listeners is that the answer is not a meaningful change in terms of what we can do. Ventilators support patients, they don't cure them. 80%, 70-80% of people will get out of intensive care based on what we're doing so far, which is really good. But no, people shouldn't be assured that we have more therapies that are really effective. That's not the case.
Okay. There's a story in one of the papers about the Irish Times, I think, that St Vincent's Hospital in Dublin confirmed that members of non-frontline staff receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Do you know, is that a situation which has been replicated in other hospitals?
Again, there was national guidance into a prioritisation of staff to get vaccinated, and as far as I know, and I can only really speak to the Mater Hospital here, that has been set up by, it's been delivered by a very, very strong vaccination team here in the hospital, and it's been very, very well delivered. We've vaccinated nearly 3,000 patients, staff in the hospital, and it's gone along the lines pretty much almost to the letter of the law of what the guidance from HSE is. I'm not aware of what's happening in Vincent, to be perfectly honest with you, but all I can say is locally we have seen, the distribution of vaccine go along exactly what has been given.
Okay.
As guidance.
Well, I think a spokesperson for the hospital said in certain instances non-frontline staff have received the vaccine to ensure that no vaccine is wasted. Professor Ross Morgan, as I said, is with us, respiratory consultant at Beaumont. You two know each other, is that right?
Yeah, good morning, Claire. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Ross.
So, Professor Morgan, will you just bring us up to date with what you're seeing there? Does it mirror what we've heard from Coleman?
Oh, yeah, I couldn't put it any better than what Coleman described in his unit. I think that you mentioned the increase and the acceleration of admissions over the last 2 weeks in this phase. And we're seeing that in that about half of the medical admissions, that means people who present to the hospital for acute care around the country, around half have a COVID or complications of this condition. So that's immensely challenging, obviously, in the emergency department. But when those patients get into the hospital, they will need to stay for a prolonged period of time. It's not a condition once you're hospitalized with that resolves rapidly. There's excellent support, as Coleman has outlined there. But the patients will spend some time in hospital with this condition, probably 2 weeks, and indeed a lot longer in many cases, in particular those who go through the intensive care unit. So we need to be aware of that when we're looking at these numbers.
So at what stage do you see them then? Are they admitted by the time they come into your care?
Yeah, we've developed, as many of my colleagues around the country, and a lot, clearly we've heard about the challenging time. It's pretty transformative in many hospitals, the acute side of respiratory care in particular. And we need to have a fairly seamless transition from the emergency department through to the hands of Coleman and his expert colleagues. But most of the patients, thankfully, in the hospital, or many of them, will not get to the intensive care unit. They may not require that level of care, but they do need care. and they need care in an environment that's quite challenged at present. So we in our hospital at least are able to provide a service that we see patients daily, and they're admitted when their requirements are high from a respiratory perspective into specialist areas. So we can manage them there, monitor them there, and I try and identify those that require the expertise of the ICU.
And prior to them reaching the ICU, what is it that you can do for them?
Well, as Coleman's outlined there, really, the most important thing about this condition is not to get it. And if you do, it's time and supportive care, principally oxygen, trying not to do any harm to people with therapies that maybe are not of use, and to try and identify those in the context of the volume of patients that we're seeing where we can that we can assist most. But there are, for example, higher levels of oxygen that we can provide in ward areas. There are devices that we can use outside of the ICU for the lungs that may tide patients over this period that they're recovering from this injury. It's again, as you've heard already, the virus hits the body. The response in the body is often, and in the lungs in particular, which would be my area of interest, the recovery from that insult, if you like, and the lungs are left frail for a period of time. Other complications can arise during that fairly difficult period for patients, often from a week to 2 weeks after the onset of this condition. So that's where we can add value, I think.
And again, the question I ask Coleman, the age profile of the people who are coming through, Ross, is it similar to what you saw earlier in the pandemic?
I think it's just greater volumes. But I mean, if we look across the maybe the 2,000-odd people who've been admitted in the past couple of weeks, about 55% of those are over the age of 65. But that means the others, 45%, are not. And they're, you know, it's always relative. When I was 15, I thought somebody who was 30 was old. But we're seeing plenty of people in their 40s and 50s who are very challenged by this virus and the complications of it at the moment. And indeed, about 10% of admissions to hospital are in the under 35 age group. Thankfully, most of those don't require the intensive care level that Coleman's been alluding to. But many of them are sick, and there is a very long tail of COVID, as we know. And you don't need to be through an intensive care to have a prolonged, protracted period of recovery, of rehabilitation, and that we're still seeing that from the first wave with active management of people who have recovered, who have survived, which is fantastic, but are still very challenged in all sorts of ways.
And for yourselves, Coleman, I'm going to come to you first on this and to Ross as well. How are you coping personally with, I'm sure you must be experiencing physical and mental exhaustion at this point.
I suppose it's good to be busy, isn't it? It does take your mind off it a lot, but the odd quiet time that you do get, it does weigh on you. Definitely it's more of a mental challenge, and I suppose for me personally, it's just that relentlessness and just to see, because I can see out onto the ambulance bay quite easily that there's this ambulance coming in time, and I was wondering how many of those are COVID. I know over time less and less will be COVID patients coming through, and I suppose that's keeping the spirits up. And while I take great sucker from is the fact that the GPs are reporting less contact in the community, and the vaccines are rolling out reasonably efficiently across all frontline healthcare, and they give me cause to be quite positive about all of this. But sure, look, everyone's is yearning for a return for normal professional life, and more importantly for personal life, and the sooner we knuckle down and get on with this, the better, I suppose.
Ross, and to you, is it relentless?
I'd echo those sentiments there, but also to say that, you know, it is, but it's also inspiring to see the changes of practice among colleagues, not just medical, the other services within the hospital, the medical, physics, technical services, estates, healthcare assistants, physios, nurses, and everybody working together. It's quite inspirational, in fact. And I think when we get through this, whenever that is, I expect we'll be left with a better service and system. And so for me, while it's, this naturally distresses, again, I'm being engaged in this at the level that where you have some sight over it, I suppose, makes it somewhat less stressful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking at across the system at the changes that have arisen, I think some inspirational in many ways.
Well, thank you both for joining us today, Professor Ross Morgan and Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin. Coming up after the break, we'll be hearing about a call from Fianna Fáil Senator Timmy Dooley to cancel the Leaving Cert and to do it now.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.